Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The explosion that killed the four Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan last spring happened with such speed and such force that one of the survivors assumed his own unit had accidentally touched off a charge. All he remembers is flying through the air enveloped in a white light. His battlefield assessment was not far off. It wasn't an enemy attack. The Canadians had been mistakenly targeted by an American F-16 pilot. It was nighttime. The pilot had seen muzzle flashes from a Canadian training exercise. He thought he was being attacked, and he hit them with a 500-pound bomb, killing four and wounding eight. It's called friendly fire, and it's one of the most awful situations of any battlefield. The actions of the two American pilots are currently being scrutinized at a hearing at the Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. Two pilots face criminal charges and a possible court-martial for the accident. Connection listeners, is it fair to blame individuals for battlefield accidents? Or should it be the system, perhaps the commanding officer, that needs to take the fall? And how is technology changing our notions of accountability on the battlefield? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have guests with us this hour who carefully study incidents and the repercussions of friendly fire. We'll get to them in just a moment. First, though, to the Barksdale Air Force Base. Harry Levins is covering the hearing for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Now, they're all back in the hearing now, but I had a chance to ask Harry a couple of moments ago what he heard yesterday from the Canadian soldiers who survived the bomb.
All of them pretty much told the same story, and the aim of the Air Force was to establish that the shooting that they were doing was A, moderate in volume, and B, horizontal in angle, not up in the air, or most of it not up in the air. But then some, you know, fairly poignant human moments emerged.
Give me an example.
Well, the first witness was a sergeant who had lost an eye. He had a glass eye and a very pronounced limp. There was a corporal who said the bomb blast threw him up into the air for what seemed like 15 minutes. There was another corporal who was knocked out when he came to. He was convinced that he had killed his own men by letting his anti-tank weapon misfire.
Harry, tell me what is expected to happen today.
Today we're going to get the cross-examination of an Air Force colonel who was on duty that night at the nerve center for the air war, which was at an air base in Saudi Arabia. He testified yesterday for the government, but most of what he had to say was classified information. And when that happens, they pull the plug on the closed-circuit TV in the newsroom, in the media room. So what we heard him say was mainly generalities to the effect that what the two pilots had done was highly unusual.
Are they hoping to get to an understanding of whether or not it was simply the two American pilots who have been charged, or whether or not there were bigger problems with the system? Is that a part of what this hearing will determine, Harry?
If the defense has its way, it certainly will. The defense lawyers have made much of what they say were problems in control, command, and communications. They say that the problems went up and down the line and that these two pilots just happened to be at the end of the line and got stuck.
Now, I gather the families of the Canadians who were killed are also on the Barksdale base, though sequestered away from you. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The families of the Americans are here in the same building as us, which is where the hearing is being held. The Canadian families are in a different building across the base, but, they have the same closed-circuit TV.
Harry, how much longer is this hearing expected to go on?
They say it will go on until a week from Saturday, perhaps, and we're going to have a Saturday session, and we're going to forget about Martin Luther King Day being a holiday.
Harry, thanks for your time.
You're welcome, sir.
That's Harry Levin, senior writer with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Let me introduce my two main guests now. Larry Sequist is head of a company called the Strategy Group, advising nations around the world on matters of conflict, including how to avoid it. His naval career spanned 32 years, during which time Mr. Sequist commanded a number of warships, including the Iowa. Scott Snook is with us as well. He's an associate professor of organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School. He served 22 years with the Army Corps of Engineers and is the author of a book called Friendly Fire. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to just reflect a little bit on what we were hearing from Harry about the hearing that's underway in Louisiana. There's certainly an adversarial aspect of this hearing, which strikes me, Scott, as a little unusual at this point in the investigation, where you've got lawyers acting for the two majors who are being charged.
Yeah, it's first of all, I mean, it's such a difficult situation. As I listened to the introduction from Barksdale, it really took me back to my personal experience when I heard about the personal aspects of the Canadian paratroopers on the ground. It's such a confusing short period of time. It all happens in a few seconds. And on the personal side, it's very difficult to make sense. And so in immediacy of the moment when these terrible tragedies happen, it feels so personal and so emotional. And then after that, there's a swirl of activity of trying to make sense what happened. And then it becomes very legalistic, very emotional, very political, very quickly. And once it gets to this point in the legal realm, sometimes it's even less easy to make sense of the entire situation and the entire tragedy that is Friendly Fire.
And Dick, you know, one of the trends here that have been eroding the sense of accountability among the military, I believe, is this introduction of these very aggressive law teams that start trying the case. In this instance, we're not even yet at a court-martial. This is an Article 32 hearing, the military's version of a kind of grand jury hearing, just to find out what happened. And I believe that accountability, because it usually involves, in these kinds of cases, very complicated issues, the military would like best to be able to examine those quietly and privately and thoroughly. When they become political and when they become supercharged by law teams, you tend to lose track of accountability and start thinking about blame.
I wonder if, in your view, Larry, that's the way things should be done in a sort of private way at this point, or whether or not, given the unbelievable presence of the media in all these situations at this point, it's even possible to do that now.
Oh, no. This is a democracy. I'm in favor of the media being as probing as possible, and it is perfectly legal to have a lawyer represent yourself. I think the onus is on the military, first of all, to be very careful about what they are doing, and secondly, to keep addressing this problem. That's one of the features of accountability. The diffusion of accountability, its erosion, that the military needs to address. They've got to fix their ability to assess accountability because of the kind of world that we're moving into.
And Scott, I mean, just reflecting on what Larry's saying, a few weeks ago, one of the lawyers went public with the fact that the pilots were being encouraged to take amphetamines in order to complete their long missions. We don't know the truth of all that. We assume some of it's going to come out at the hearing, but it sure changes the equation when you're saying, oh, look, it was just, you know, one pilot who made a mistake, two pilots who make a mistake. All of a sudden, people are saying to themselves, wow, are all the guys flying F-16s high on something?
Yeah, I mean, the use of amphetamines or go pills and no-go pills, but it's very common, and it's used. They take them voluntarily, but especially particular to fight fatigue on these long missions. They've been used for years. I'm certainly no medical expert, so I can't comment exactly on the findings and the potential impact. But again, it goes back to Larry's point. This is the lawyers doing their job, you know, and anything, in my opinion, listening to these conversations, both public in private over the last couple of weeks, it does move us away from issues of accountability and focuses on very public displays of issues. You see the wives of the pilots in the media talking about these are American heroes. They're not criminals. Why are we trying them? And then you throw this out, this use of amphetamines. But rarely do we hear the specifics of the actual actions and the context of the actions that the pilots took. So the lawyers are doing their job.
And you know, Dick, on the amphetamines, the go pills,
yeah.
To me, the accountability issue here is the accountability of the chain of command's decisions to require their pilots to use speed them up to put them in the air and slow them down to put them into bed. Yesterday on the Internet, the Institute for Military Justice, a Washington, D.C.-based organization, very respectable one, circulated the website of the Air Force's own site that provides the managerial framework for doing this, the disclosure agreements, the record keeping. I think at some point someone needs to examine that issue of why did the Air Force decide this was important when we wouldn't allow a truck driver on the highway with speed.
And just so we don't wind up trying these two on the radio, to step back from it, Scott, it is in large part a question of, is it the system to blame? Is it the individuals? Is it even possible to extract from such an elaborate system as the military one individual and say, that's where the blame lies?
Yes, very difficult, but it comes down to the question, the broader question of accountability. I mean, risk analysis, whether it's about the go pills or the no-go pills, or whether we should fly the extended ranges, or exactly the correct balance for the rules of engagement, what's proportionality, what type of weapons to use. Risk analysis is the job of commanders at all levels, and they have to go through and weigh the risks. So same way with a truck driver getting up and trying to drive 24 hours, you weigh the challenges of, you know, which more important. And commanders are responsible for doing that at all levels.
Larry, as we look ahead to the possibility of another war, this one in Iraq, I've lost track of how many American service personnel are there or en route, but the figure 150,000 is stuck in my head. Will this be something that we're talking about again in the months ahead? Is it inevitable?
Well, let's hope it's not inevitable, but it is quite likely that we will unfortunately have more of these kinds of friendly fire, blue-on-blue engagements in Iraq war, as we understand it from what the plans are, with something over 100,000 people, airplanes coming from different directions, the Army expected to move very rapidly. This is not going to be apparently an old-fashioned battle of terrain, but the Army leapfrogging around cities. You're going to have all of the factors mixed together that add up to risks of friendly fire. Distributed command systems in which an individual pilot with a long-range missile may be interacting with a special forces person or an Army person on the ground, controlled by a command center hundreds of miles away, kind of battle being managed by people rather than warriors with a personal sense of direct engagement.
And Connection and listeners, we're going to pick that up when we come back after our break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. How is technology changing our notions of accountability on the battlefield? Let's talk more about that. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. This hour, a look at the fallout from friendly fire. One such incident that received a lot of attention in America happened in Iraq 9 years ago. A pair of U.S. fighter jets patrolling the no-fly zone mistakenly marked two U.S. Black Hawks as Iraqi helicopters. They shot them down. 26 people were killed. Among those who died was U.S. Lieutenant Laura Piper. Her mother, Joan Piper, joins us now on the line from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I can't imagine what goes through your mind as you hear people once again talking about friendly fire as if it almost never goes away.
I think realistically it doesn't go away. My heart, you know, goes out to the families. I know what they're going through. Their lives will be forever changed. I know they're trying to understand what happened to their loved ones so that they can meet some kind of closure with this.
And the families of the pilots as well?
Yes, yes. It's difficult for everyone.
And when you're watching a hearing like this go on, and I understand the investigations into the accident that claimed your daughter's life went on for months.
Years, actually. Oh, 2 years by the time we'd finished with the last Senate investigation.
There was Senate, there was Congress, there was GAO,
yes.
There was, At the time that it's going on, or even at the end, Joan, is it looking for some kind of rational answer, or is it looking for blame as well?
Well, my husband had just retired from the military. He was a retired colonel. He was an Air Force pilot, so we had a good background of knowledge. And we understood that blame is part of the grieving process, but we weren't looking to place blame. We were looking for the truth. And you can't come to terms with this unless you have the truth. And when you lose a son or a daughter or a husband in the service of this country, that's the biggest sacrifice that you can make with the exception of your own life. And the military has an obligation to provide you with the truth in return for the sacrifice that you made. And so we were truly seeking the truth, not to put blame on anyone. And it was difficult for my husband because he was a pilot and he understood, therefore the grace of God go any of us. But the situation in our case was much too unusual. There was no heat of battle. The Blackhawks were out there. They were out there every day. This day was a clear day, near perfect visibility. The F-15s entered the area. Only four planes are out there, the two F-15s and the two Blackhawks. And 7 minutes later, 26 people are laying on the desert floor. How do you explain that?
Well, I'm going to ask you whether or not, in your view, the military system that you watched kick into action to investigate that is one that is designed to get at the truth. Did you have even that satisfaction?
In our case, and it is documented, and I did write a book about it so that there would be documentation, and the book was The Chain of Events, the military knew the truth. But they were protecting the pilots. The chief of staff at the time, General Merrill McPeak, was an ex-fighter pilot, and he was protecting those fighter pilots. So they really jury-rigged the judicial system to make sure that these pilots would not be charged. And we, you know, as we saw that happening, my husband and I, so loyal to the military all of our life. We had another son at the Air Force Academy at the time. We were really hoping that wasn't going to happen. My husband stood up for the military until it just got to be too black and white, and it was very obvious what they were doing. So then we had to use the press to help Congress hold the military accountable.
Joan, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Joan Piper is a teacher in San Antonio, Texas. Her daughter, Laura, was killed by friendly fire 9 years ago. In fact, it was an incident that one of my guests, Scott Snook, did his doctoral dissertation on and then wrote his own book called Friendly Fire, The Accidental Shootdown of U.S. Blackhawks Over Northern Iraq. So listening to Joan speak brings back those memories for you as well, I suppose.
It does, and it really it brings back a tough – and what makes this so difficult for me is what's the difference between an explanation and an excuse? And really, that's a fundamental question that I've grappled with for years. I was trying to explain how it happened. As a behavioral scientist, as a practitioner in the profession of arms, Joan was talking about, we want the truth. I wanted to understand how it could happen. I wanted to get in the minds of each of the actors because there's no way that the two F-15 pilots on the 14th of April 1994 woke up and looked at each other and said, let's go shoot down some Army helicopters today, just like this last spring. There's no way these two F-16 pilots woke up that morning and looked at each other and said, let's go drop a bomb on some Canadian paratroopers. So at some point, you have to understand how some of the best trained, best equipped people in the world in what I think is one of the best organizations in the world, can periodically fail.
And in many cases, and in most cases, one of the best-led organizations in the world. And Larry Sequist, you spent 32 years in the Navy, and the Navy's ethos, if it's anything, is that the captain accepts responsibility. When we talk about cases like the 1994 shooting down of the Black Hawk helicopters, or even the case of the pilots that's being heard in Barksdale right now, it's about the people who pulled the trigger. It seems so rarely about the people who are responsible for them. Is that a mistake?
Oh, no. It should be the mistake would be to not hold accountable the chain of command who set the climate around the trigger pullers, around the pilots. As you said, I'm a former commanding officer of warships, and as a captain, your responsibility is rather crystalline, that you are the person that is in charge and responsible. Whatever someone does inside your command that may be mistaken, you are personally responsible for. And what we see, Dick, in these modern battlefields, of course, is that we don't have these crystalline military organizations where you can find one person who is deliberately in charge, directly in charge. It's worthwhile, I think, to remind ourselves of what accountability is. It's the responsibility for a personal decision, in my view. What we're looking for are errors of judgment, professional decisions that should have gone a different way. That's what we're trying to hold accountable.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll take our first call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Wayne's on the phone. Hi, Wayne.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My point is that we can talk about accountability all day, but there's something cultural in the institution of the military that makes it react almost immediately to sort of cover up or to minimize any kind of controversial occurrence like this. Like friendly fire or other incidents in where the military might be embarrassed or might be at some seem to be at fault in some way.
It's almost possible. I mean, it's possible to understand the instinct to do that, though, isn't it, Wayne?
Well, certainly it is. We see it in police departments. We see it in other institutions that have to go on the line and do things that put themselves at risk and put the in an effort to protect the public interest. But the thing that strikes me about all this is that the amazing technological advances that we've made in the military, the institution itself has not kept up with those incredible advances in terms of its ability to accept responsibility, to be open about what it does, and to be willing to account for its actions. It's too often a tendency to either just scapegoat somebody or to cover up, hunker down and cover up. And I think that's unfortunate. I don't know, maybe the Congress or maybe somebody needs to look at it in a more fundamental way than simply looking at these individual incidents of that.
Wayne, let me ask Larry Sequist to respond to that. Has he got his finger on something, Larry?
Yes. The caller's making a very strong point here, and I would hope that rather than being imposed by the Congress, that the pressure ought to come from within the military itself, its own professional standards, saying that we need to be accountable. I think one of the roots of the problem this caller is pointing about, this instinct, we all have this instinct to cover up when we make a mistake, and then we have to say, no, I need to fess up to it. But for military organizations these days, these big mistakes risk big losses of budgets and systems in Washington. And there is a quick instinct among the leadership of the military to not allow an incident in the field to risk their budget. And I think we need to understand that aura around the chain of command can be very powerful.
Do you suppose, Scott, that there's a lag here, that the killing skill of the military has outstripped the communication protection skill that needs to be there for people who are on the ground on your side?
Well, clearly the advances in technology and the way modern warfare has changed in this distributed nature, and we have more and more junior people, much more decentralized, no clear front lines. The nature of warfare has changed dramatically. Now, whether it's outstripped the human capabilities to manage it effectively is not the way I'd frame it. I'd actually frame it that in terms of normal accidents, which is a theory that we have a lot of support for, that these are always going to happen. There will always be a person in the loop, no matter how much technology you put out there. Somebody's going to program the technology. Somebody's going to read it. Somebody's going to coordinate how they interact, the different pieces of the technology interlap. So I think our expectations that technology is going to solve these problems is just unrealistic. You can look at civil aviation. You know, for years we've thrown, every time a plane went down, we threw another bell or whistle and fixed a plane. Planes now are extremely safe technologically, mechanically, and they continue to fall out of the sky, and they will continue to fall out of the sky. But increasingly because of human error and systems errors, and less so because of mechanical failure. Person will always be in the loop.
Dick, may I add that there is obviously the technology is getting more and more embedded in the battlefield. Computers are making decisions about whether or not something is safe or giving flags to the operators. But I think what is actually going on is that the human dimension is becoming more and more important, and therefore these accountability issues of was the decision right are more important. We have individual special forces sergeants now on the front lines making a personal decision about whether he should shoot into an Afghan village. We're going to see those kinds of things in Iraq. Where it's the human beings in this network and the quality of decisions, their ability to master this battlefield that really is at issue. And accountability is the way in which we take the temperature of how well they were able to do that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That he's absolutely right. Increasingly now, if you just look at, say, B-52 bombers, I mean, during the Vietnam War, presidents were making decisions where the bombs will be dropped and how it will be dropped. In this most recent area in Afghanistan, we have special forces, non-commissioned officers, totally decentralized, out on their own, trying to make sense of an increasingly complex and ambiguous and volatile battlefield, actually talking directly to pilots and making those split-second decisions. So absolutely, the human dimension is going up, and we're asking more and more junior people in the military to make much more lethal decisions than they had to do in the past because of the changing nature. So personal accountability is actually coming to the forefront.
Larry, let me go to another call if I can. Thanks to Wayne for calling in, to Ashland, Massachusetts now, and Imran's on the line. Hi, Imran.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
My question, I'd like to bring it back to the issue of redressability, whether it's from the loved ones of victims or perhaps even, let's say, Afghanis who are the victims of a bombing. Why, or perhaps, does the military have in its laws the theory, the negligence theory of strict liability? You know, the notion that some activities are so inherently dangerous that no matter what precautions you take, if someone gets injured, liability is imposed right away on the actor.
Scott.
Yeah, the way I was thinking about this is across different professions. And if you think about policemen and what happens when there's a shooting, the immediate response of the organization is to place them on administrative leave, typically, and then the Internal Affairs Division will look at it. And then if society decides that wasn't adequate enough, somebody external to the police department. Same thing, lawyers. There's automatic appeals for death sentence for capital punishment cases. Doctors, if there's a death in the hospital, there's an internal board. Same thing. In our case, this strict liability issue is probably not as clear because the historical nature of warfare and the battlefield, the casualties were so huge. We never stopped in the past in World Wars in Korea and Vietnam. The total number of casualties were so huge that we never stopped to, rarely stopped to see if the bullets that put our soldiers down or friendly combatants down were ours or someone else's. But because the casualties total now are so few, which is a good thing, and the increasingly lethal nature of warfare, this now is an important issue that the caller brings up. How should we think about the strict liability notion when it comes to the military as it relates to other professions?
One of the problems with strict liability is whose standards are you going to use? Traditionally, a military unit, say a Navy ship that got involved in an accident at sea, would have that incident investigated entirely within the Navy using Navy cultural standards and Navy rules. Now, as we have in this current case, two countries involved, many of these cases are different services, units from different organizations working together. So it's Air Force, Army, Special Forces, Canadians, all mixed together, and it's not clear exactly whose standards and procedures apply.
It's been suggested that because these two were charged with involuntary manslaughter and assault and dereliction of duty, that perhaps they're being pinpointed more severely because another country is involved. Do these types of hearings and investigations take on that sort of nature of politics?
Well, I would say yes. Partly because of the money politics, making sure that this doesn't damage the whole institution because these become so public. So I think, yes, there is a risk of that.
And yet, historically, we have some examples that while the pressure is always there, I think, when there are people involved from different countries and different services, people outside your own household, the Aviano, Italy case where the A6 pilots cut the gondola cables, huge potential, I mean, to the point where we're at the prime minister, president, commander-in-chief level about losing our basing rights in Italy, huge pressure. And yet, I was surprised that at the end they were able to actually call out or disentangle the politics from that, and I think came out with appropriate decision there. In the friendly fire case that we heard about in northern Iraq that Joan Piper was talking about, that I wrote a book about, again, we had people, victims from different countries,
right,
and from different services, and yet in that case, the political pressure was strong and no one was held accountable.
There was a trust that the system in place would look after the interests both of the victims' families and the people responsible. Connection listeners, friendly fire, who carries blame, responsibility? Who is accountable? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK, and this hour, a conversation about friendly fire. With me on the program, Larry Sequist. He is CEO and chairman of the Strategy Group, focusing on conflict prevention and post-conflict transformation. During the Gulf War, he was acting assistant deputy undersecretary of defense for policy planning, working under Paul Wolfowitz. He's a retired Navy commander. With me in the studio, Scott Snook, retired Army colonel, author of Friendly Fire, the accidental shootdown of U.S. Blackhawks over northern Iraq. He's also an associate professor of organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School. And we'll go back to the calls from Hadley, Massachusetts. Melissa's joining us. Hi, Melissa.
Hello.
Go ahead.
The point I'd like to make is that this whole thing is as much a diplomatic fiasco as a military one.
You're talking about the incident involving the Canadians who were killed.
Yeah. I'm from Canada, and I talk a lot to my family, and I surf the CBC website. And I think the whole trial that's going on now would be a lot less supercharged if President Bush had fulsomely apologized during the first days after the incident. The impression we got in Canada was that the American attitude was, oh, sorry, yeah, that happens, right? Friendly fire, okay, get on with it. And the whole country felt victimized. It's not just the families of the Princess Pats that were killed, but the whole country. We felt as if the Americans had been really very disrespectful. And I think that's one reason a lot of Canadians are crying out for those pilots' blood, is they felt that American life was held too dear and Canadian life too cheaply.
I'll just add, if I can, Melissa, sort of a couple of details I remember, because we were covering the story at the time, that it was about 48 hours after the Canadians had been killed before President George Bush actually looked down the lens of a video camera and spoke to Canadian mm-hmm. people, saying that he felt awful about it, and there had been opportunities prior to that he had
exactly.
not taken that opportunity.
And a lot of resentment built up in that time.
And it's also worth noting that Canada is not the military country that the United States is. In fact, these four were the first to die from friendly fire in over 50 years. And so that piece of news hangs over the Canadians as well. Larry Sequest, back to the question of whether or not the diplomatic aspect of this and the situation that Melissa has described is a part of the investigation, can be separated from that.
Yes, and it certainly will be in the years ahead. The kinds of scraps that our troops will get involved in that lead to these kinds of situations. Another term for accountability or diplomacy here is setting an example. The American military particularly, I think, prides itself and should pride itself on being an example of a democracy's military. And we should not take a decision by the White House for an immediate profuse apology to come out from everyone. So I think that's an important point, and it leads back to this sense of covering up rather than embracing accountability. And let me say, if I may, Dick, about accountability, while it is an iron standard that can eventually have you in front of a court-martial, that the military commanders that I know welcome accountability. They welcome the privilege of being responsible for something that could result in their decisions being examined. I think it's an important point of pride in our profession.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Melissa, thanks for that. We're going to Chicago now, and Deb's joining us. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Thank you. I've got a quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. But
okay.
I'm just wondering, if we start to hold our soldiers accountable for accidents or, you know, friendly fire incidences like this that go on, how will that affect in the future getting people to join the military and actually participate in these?
Sure, or the people who are already in, how
right,
are they going
exactly.
to regard their jobs? Uh-huh. Scott, why don't you start on that?
Yeah, what makes these cases so dramatic in many senses, aside from the obvious human tragedies, our last two callers have hit on, the victims are widespread. They're not just the direct victims that were killed in this case, Canada. I mean, a whole feeling. They're geopolitical victims, and so organizations have to deal with it compassionately. But the potential unintended consequences of how these pilots are handled when they make this mistake, there are all sorts of considerations that the organization has to take into account. One, are we going to have several wings of timid fighter pilots looking over their shoulders in the next high-intensity conflict? If they are concerned that they may end up in jail for making the wrong judgment under combat conditions and very quick decide. Further down the road, the caller mentions, you know, are people going to join the profession if they're worried about, hey, we see this with doctors and liability right now in several states in this country, that it ultimately affects the health of the profession in terms of how we deal with professional failures within the profession. Continue to attract people, continue to retain good people, to continue to give them the type of a professional autonomy they need to mm-hmm. to have to actually be effective in their practice. So, yeah, the potential unintended consequences down the road about how the organization and society through its multiple pressures in the media and through politics, how we handle this are widespread, much wider than the specific incident.
Larry, is it even conceivable to imagine a circumstance in the future where the chain of command would be streamlined to the point where you don't end up with all the pilots wondering whether or not, you know, their decision will be second-guessed and perhaps send them to jail, that there is the clean line of accountability that you keep drawing us back to? Are we past that stage?
No, I think we need to continue to work at the problem of finding accountability and making sure that those up in the chain of command feel accountable down to the people, whether they're pilots, sergeants on the ground making decisions.
But it goes the other way, too. If you have that chain of command and the commanding officer knows that he or she has that control, then the pilots and the people below them know that they're responsible to the boss at the top, right?
Correct. But let me make the point, Dick, that in the American democracy, and I think in Canada's democracy also, there's an important constitutional principle that American military officers are responsible down to the men and women who work for them and to those families of the men and women who work for them and to the general public. It's not just accountability up to your bosses. We are not a democracy which lets a few privileged people run the military. These people are hired by our democracy and need to be accountable down.
All right, to Medford, Massachusetts now. Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you? I'd say the perspective that I come from as a former combat Marine in Vietnam who was experienced a lot of close in air strikes from my organization with 1st Marine Division. I think it's a good idea that the pilots, they definitely have to review the accountability and then examine after the accountability. I'm not necessarily what the disposition of a case should be with the pilots, but certainly review the training and the rules of engagement. It sounds to me like a type of situation where they definitely have to review situations where the pilots, without being called in with the air controllers to drop in airstrikes, that whole area has to be reviewed. The other thing I would say, I myself was involved on at least one occasion where we were dropped airstrikes on top of us by friendly air, and that happens. And that's the fog of war. I know the exact October 23rd, 68, we were south of Da Nang in a place called the Go Nai Island, and we were assaulting it, and we had marked the captain. Now, I heard one thing your gentleman mentioned. At my experience of 13 months in combat, our airstrikes were always controlled by either captain, lieutenant, or platoon sergeant. There was nobody above us because we were the front, we were the tip of the spear when we were fighting over there.
And does the lieutenant or the platoon sergeant then have to carry the full responsibility?
Absolutely. But when you have to understand, you get people, got dying all around you from small arms fire and you're dug in and you're assaulting a bunker or a hill, hills. Those type of things happen. But the incident I was going to tell you about, our captain had called in and had the U.S. Phantom Air Force came in, and he marked the position, said, told them to come in one way, like parallel to where our position was. That was fine. And he said, okay, drop the bombs. When they came in the other way, they went perpendicular, dropped them on top of us. Fortunately, there was two dud 250-pound bombs, and we survived. 20 minutes to a half hour later, my 3rd platoon was assaulting across there. They came in the right way, dropped the ears on about two or three companies of NVA soldiers, and my 3rd platoon survived the whole mission because of the airstrikes. But the point of that is that's the fog of war, or things like that can happen. And I think what I would say out of this whole situation, I think that the training of these pilots, particularly for like the U.S. Air Force and versus like Marine fighter pilots who have a lot more training with infantry troops, that's, I think, what's going to come out of this. I hope.
Well, Peter, one of my guests, Scott Snook, was also a victim of friendly fire in Grenada in 1983, right?
That's right. And the issue he raises here around training and rules of engagement, absolutely right. I mean, how often do we actually, do ground troops train with close air support in peacetime, and especially in particular the Air Force, how much experience they have in dealing with this situation. But the right to self-defense is always going to be there in the rules of engagement. And in fact, ultimately, that's what these pilots relied on. And it comes back to the issue of autonomy. Would we ever really want to deny someone the right to self-defense?
And if they feel they're being threatened, I mean, I think you've got real issues. I think you can't assail the right to self-defense.
We talk about public, or we talk about accountability. We also should talk about public expectations, whether or not the expectations that the general public have for the type of technological warfare that takes place are unrealistic at this point. Larry?
No, I think those public expectations are correct. As I understand the attitude of people like Mrs. Piper, who lost her daughter, and the other family members, they expect, as she said, to know the truth, to feel like that death was not in vain, that someone learned something. And that's something our Marine caller from Vietnam just mentioned. The real point of accountability, the most important point, is to find out what went wrong. Was there a procedure wrong and a piece of equipment wrong, a piece of training that led to a wrong decision? That's what needs to be changed. We tend to focus on the courtroom melodrama, mm-hmm. but it's really the procedural outcome. And the people, I think, are expecting us to learn those lessons and do that visibly. That's what the public, I believe, and as I said, in a democracy, has a constitutional right to expect of us.
Absolutely. I agree with him that the expectations of truth and transparency and learning that we're going to continue to learn from these incidents and not get bogged down in the scapegoating is correct. But the public's expectation, I disagree with the sense, and I'm not sure that's what you're saying, Larry, the public's expectation, I fear, about warfare, not modern warfare, I think has been skewed since the end of the Gulf War, that you can actually have these sterile warfares. We can employ deadly force around the world without having friendly casualties. And that's a topic for another day. But technology will never solve this issue.
But the military is, in many ways, its own worst enemy there in talking about the ability to have laser-guided bombs and surgical strikes and that sort of thing. Larry?
And, you know, Dick, you mentioned earlier, would we expect to see these kinds of things in Iraq? Where I really worry about these things happening also is in this global war on terrorism, where we're putting small special forces teams covertly out around the world. We've got CIA groups operating covertly with drone airplanes and so on. There is going to be killing and mistakes done out in that, and it's all going to be hidden. Somehow another of the accountability problems is figuring out a way to bring the discipline and the benefits of accountability to those covert operations.
Larry, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Larry Sequist is retired Navy commander. Scott Snook, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Scott is a retired Army colonel, author of Friendly Fire, the accidental shoot down of U.S. Blackhawks over northern Iraq. Earlier in the program, we talked with Harry Levins of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and Joan Piper, mother of Lieutenant Laura Piper, who was killed in that 94 Iraq incident. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WB.